The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome back, everyone. And we're going to now follow through our distinguished guests this morning and the strong tone they set for sunshine and openness with four panels and an additional luncheon speaker from the White House. And I'll be talking about the other panels later on. But first, I want to mention something that applies sort of across the board, where something you might want to be thinking about during the day. The last panel of the day deals with Exemption 3, and we will be rolling out, so to speak, our vetted compilation of Exemption 3 statutes. We have analyzed very carefully from an academic perspective all the hundreds of statutes that have been invoked or claimed to be Exemption 3 statutes by agencies over the years and have come to a conclusion that there is a certain number. It's a three-digit number, not a four-digit number. And what's significant for you is that we will be taking guesses during the day. You can make your best guess as to what that number is, and I will let you know already we had one guess yesterday that was as high as 1,100. That's a little bit on the high side. Another guess at 250. We had another guess today at 373, I think. And whoever comes closest to the actual number, which we will reveal later on this afternoon, and this is not like The Price is Right. This is closest whether you go over or not. You don't have to be underneath. Just closest to the actual number. There's actually a prize that's been awarded. It was awarded yesterday at the museum at the first FOID Sunshine Week program that was held there at the Freedom Center, the First Amendment Center at the Freedom Forum. And that is a free guided tour of the museum, which I believe is at least a $20 value, not available at any stores, and it's something that is certainly worth considering. So just let us know as the day progresses what your guess is, and then we'll reveal that actual number later on this afternoon in our last panel. But before we get to our last panel, we're going to have a first panel dealing with big issues in FOIA litigation, and this is something we've not done before. But we thought the time was right to finally focus on big litigation cases. I should mention, by the way, and again, this is something that applies across the board, that we try to pack in as much content as we can during this program so we don't spend a lot of time talking about biographical information on the speakers. We provide that to you and on our website as handout information. So that we can more quickly get to the actual meat of the subject matter. So what I'll be doing for at least a couple of these panels is introducing just the moderator, who will then briefly introduce the speakers, and then you'll be able to make reference to the bio information, with one exception, and that is on this panel, one of the speakers had a family medical emergency yesterday. Leonard Scheipman, but we have a very strong replacement, someone who worked with Leonard on the AT&T versus FCC case that we'll be talking about, Henry Whitaker. So you won't find Henry's bio information in your package, but Tom Blanton, your erstwhile moderator, has that as well. And as to Art Spitzer, he's been delayed, I believe. He might or might not be joining us as we go along, but we're going to get started at this point, and I will turn you over to Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. I'm also a fill-in because the deserved moderator of this panel is the National Security Archive's own litigator, Meredith Fuchs, but for many of you who may have witnessed her receiving the Madison Award together with crew yesterday at the museum, you'll know that Meredith is on to even bigger and better things on Capitol Hill, where she'll be chief counsel for investigations of the House Energy and Commerce committee. And so I've been tagged to fill in to introduce this panel about current litigation. And it's an interesting and diverse crew. Dan mentioned that Henry has very generously volunteered or been volunteered, as the case may be, to stand in for Leonard Scheitman. Henry has a distinguished resume, practiced with Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, clerked on the Supreme Court and for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, graduate of Yale and of Harvard, and currently working with Leonard on the appeal in the ATT versus FCC case, which is one of the most unusual information access cases I've ever heard of, because in this case, the government's trying to release the information. And so Henry will give us an update on where that stands. Then I'll ask Mark Rotenberg to pitch in on several cases that the Electronic Privacy Information Center has brought together with some of the rest of us on cases like the warrantless wiretapping memos and ones that EPIC has led on, like the body scanner issue and presidential directive on cybersecurity. And then I'll call on Tom Golden, partner at Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, to give us an update on this extraordinary case brought by Bloomberg against the Federal Reserve, which has enormous implications, I think, for transparency on all the economic stimulus matters and overall on deciding whether and what realms of the government deserve a cone of silence and whether that is actually damaging to our economy or useful for economic performance. And so with no further ado, let me just briefly give a plug for what Meredith would have said if she was the moderator, which is just this. It's what she talked about yesterday and what she won the Madison Award for, which is the White House email litigation, which we experienced between 2008 and 2009, a real night and day approach by the White House and by the Justice Department in terms of coming to a settlement. This is the issue of whether and what the Bush administration did about archiving its email, having gotten rid of the Clinton archiving system and a technology transition in about 2002, never quite replacing it with a system that would actually save the email and ultimately having millions of messages go missing, something that we didn't find out until the Scooter Libby investigation and then Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington through a whistleblower found out more detail about choices the White House made or did not make to do archiving. And with some help from the Jones Day Law Firm, some wonderful lawyers there, some help from the Obama White House Counsel's Office, some help from the National Archives and Records Administration, I think over the past year we worked out an extraordinary settlement that makes sure that from day one, White House email messages in the current administration are being saved, including the President's own BlackBerry messages, and a recovery process that actually has brought back upwards of 22 million messages. But as John Podesta remarked about the volume of material, I'll just give you a bottom line, because the National Security Archive has been involved in White House email litigation since 1989. In fact, Leonard Scheitman and I had some of our most wonderful interactions in various appellate courtrooms in the late 80s and early 90s. But the email litigation over the last couple of decades, and all we have is estimates here, maybe Gary Stern can correct me on this, we've saved about 250,000, roughly, email from the Reagan White House. The first email system came in about 1982. For the Bush 41, the estimates are somewhere in the 400,000 range, 400,000, 450,000. For Bill Clinton's 8 years, 32 million. And the latest estimate we have in the settlement of the lawsuit with the Obama White House is that on the tapes and on the systems handed off to National Archives from the George W. Bush White House, 220 million individual email messages. So the volume here is extraordinary. The historical value is unparalleled. And the potential for searchability, for accountability over the long term is extraordinary. And I just want to give a kudo right up front to the folks both on the government side, our partners at Jones Day and at Crewe and elsewhere, for working out a settlement that I think is truly historic and deserves remarking on this Freedom of Information Day. And with that brief introduction, let me ask Henry to bring us up to date on the ATTV FCC matter, and then we'll just go in order down the panel, and then we would welcome your questions. Henry Whitaker.
Thanks, Tom. Well, unfortunately, my marching orders today are to be somewhat boring, because the case I'm going to discuss, AT&T versus FCC, is still pending. It's the Department of Justice is currently deciding whether or not to seek Supreme Court review of the Court of Appeals decision in the case. So I'm somewhat limited in what I can say about the case. But what I can say about the case is I'll just go through the case briefly, and then I'll go through what the government has said about the case. Thank you, Tom. And so AT&T versus FCC raises the question of whether corporations have personal privacy rights under FOIA Exemption 7C. And as many of you probably know, Exemption 7C is the exemption that protects from presumptive disclosure under FOIA records collected for law enforcement purposes. And what happened in this case was one of a trade association that represents many of AT&T's competitors called CompTel submitted a FOIA request to the FCC requesting an investigative file that the FCC had compiled about AT&T, about potential malfeasance. And AT&T resisted that request on the ground that to disclose that information, they asserted some other grounds, but the ground that we're concerned with today is that they said that this disclosure of this information would infringe AT&T's corporate right to personal privacy under Exemption 7C. The FCC granted the FOIA request and ruled that the Exemption 7C does not, in fact, protect corporate privacy rights. Again, the language in Exemption 7C is, quote, personal privacy, and the FCC said that phrase only concerns the privacy of individuals. The FCC agreed to stay the disclosure while AT&T took a petition for review to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, the Third Circuit, agreed with AT&T and ruled that for the first time in FOIA's history, that a corporation has a personal privacy right under Exemption 7C. And the Third Circuit's reasoning, I think it's fair to say, is on this score somewhat wooden. What the Third Circuit said was, the Third Circuit relied centrally on the definition of the term person in FOIA. FOIA, like many other federal statutes, has a definition section, and since it applies to legal entities, it defines the term person to include corporations. And what the Third Circuit said was, since the term personal in the phrase personal privacy is the adjectival variant of the term person, that the term personal privacy thereby must also include corporate and protect corporate privacy. Now, another thing the court said, and the reason that we're in this sort of odd posture that Tom mentioned before, the Third Circuit also said that the FCC's own regulations prohibit the FCC from, or at least presumptively prohibit the FCC from disclosing information that is protected by FOIA Exemption 7C, meaning that the FCC, at least presumptively, is precluded from disclosing the information as long as it's protected by FOIA Exemption 7C. Normally, as many of you know, just because information is subject to a FOIA exemption does not mean that the government doesn't have discretion to disclose it if it likes, unless there's some other statute prohibiting disclosure. That's the normal posture. The government, if it's subject to an exemption, the government may withhold it, but it doesn't have to. In this case, the Third Circuit said we have to, at least presumptively. And there are several problems that the government has pointed out with the Third Circuit's reasoning. Number one, the first being that it's not true. The statute does not define the term personal privacy to include corporate privacy. It defines a separate term, which is person. And there are numerous places in which federal statutes, in their definitions, they say this is a definition not only for that term, but also for variants of the term. And that's not present in FOIA. Various other reasons. If you look, the ordinary meaning of the term personal, we pointed out, if you look in the dictionary, that phrase is traditionally concerned with individuals and not artificial legal entities like corporations. And that conclusion, in our view, draws particular force from the fact that it's the phrase personal privacy. Because privacy, as many of you probably are saying, I saw the reaction of some people when I described what the Third Circuit said, the concept of privacy, one ordinarily thinks, is something bound up in the dignity and autonomy of individuals, and is not something that is necessarily transferable to a corporation, which can't be embarrassed or shamed in the way that an individual can. And the other thing that I'd point out with what we've said about the Third Circuit's reasoning is there's an entirely separate FOIA exemption, Exemption 4, which Congress did protect certain corporate secrets, and that exception protects certain trade secrets and other confidential business information, where Congress was quite clearly concerned with protecting corporate secrets. And it would be extremely odd if Congress had taken the time and effort to carve out that specifically delineated exception to presumptive disclosure of corporate secrets, and then smuggle into Exemption 7C at the same time, this entirely separate freestanding category of protection of corporate secrecy in the context of law enforcement records. Now, we've also pointed out in our filings the implications of the Third Circuit's decision. As I mentioned at the outset, the Third Circuit's decision is really unique of its kind. I don't know, we are not aware of any case, any source that has previously suggested that Exemption 7C might extend to the privacy of corporations. And what this decision means then is that it would significantly change the way the government has to process the many, many FOIA requests it receives each year government-wide, perhaps even depending on the jurisdiction in which the FOIA litigation might eventually be brought, because as we also pointed out, the Third Circuit's decision is in at least considerable tension with lines of cases interpreting FOIA Exemption 6, which uses the same phrase, personal privacy, and also Exemption 7C, seemingly suggesting that phrase does not extend to the privacy corporation. So the Third Circuit's decision certainly puts the government in a bind. And the second problem we've pointed out with the Third Circuit's decision is that, again, since the Third Circuit has held that the government is precluded from disclosing this information, what it will do is, where there is some independent statute or regulation that may prohibit disclosure of information that's subject to a FOIA exemption, this will prevent the government from disclosing information about corporate malfeasance that, in the government's view, the public has a right to know. And so we've vigorously disputed the Third Circuit's decision and are currently deciding whether that, unfortunately, the Third Circuit denied our petition to seek rehearing of that decision, and we're currently considering whether or not to file a cert petition to ask the Supreme Court to take the case.
Mark, do you want to pick up there?
Well, I'm just thinking that if corporations get 7C, can we get B4? Is that fair?
I have no pull on that question.
I mean, I've got some trade secrets. I know that.
Bring your microphone up closer if you don't mind.
But okay. So let me just say a couple of words about EPIC. We're kind of an unusual but frequent participant in open government meetings. We're the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and very much committed, of course, to open government, and have done a lot of work over the years on sort of high-impact FOIA cases, revealing the government's clipper chip encryption scheme, the FBI's wiretap proposal, and other issues. I'm going to talk this morning about one of our current cases, which I think helps demonstrate the importance of FOIA. And it concerns the body scanners now being deployed in the nation's airports. These are technically called whole body imaging devices. They include backscatter, X-ray, and millimeter wave. We began our interest in this technology back in 2005. when the TSA first began to make grants for research and then for deployment of these devices, we stepped up our interest in April of last year when the TSA quietly announced that it was planning to make whole-body imaging devices the primary screening device in U.S. airports. Now, let me say that sentence again, because most people, I don't think, are aware of this. The TSA is planning to replace the metal detectors in the nation's airports with whole-body imaging devices, and they had made that determination prior to the December 25th incident. And we began at that time to step up public pressure on the program. There were 30 organizations that wrote to DHS Secretary Napolitano, urged her to begin a public rulemaking on the proposal, and also we began a FOIA request, made an expedited review, went through the administrative appeals, and in December of this past year, actually just prior to December 25th, received vendor contracts and technical specifications prepared by the TSA on the design of the devices. And it was very interesting because, as many of you may have heard, the TSA has assured the public that these devices, which literally see through your clothes and in the first instance get a very detailed image of you undressed, did not have the capability to store, record, or transmit images. They said there was no privacy concern because they had filtering techniques, no storage capability, and that the privacy concerns had been addressed. Well, of course, after December 25th, the debate accelerated quite a bit because there was an enormous amount of pressure placed on the administration and the Department of Homeland Security. It's kind of ominous to have that in the background. You know? All right, so it wasn't enormous pressure.
They knew you were speaking, yes.
There was a bit of pressure. Is that okay? A bit of pressure. To deploy more of these devices in the U.S. airports. And when we began to look at the documents that we had obtained through our FOA litigation, the case is captioned EPIC versus DHS, we found something very interesting. Not only was it not true that the devices could not store and record images, the TSA had required in their specification documents that were provided to the vendors that the devices had to have the ability to store and record images. And as to the filtering techniques, they had various levels of users that allowed TSA personnel to essentially turn off all the filters and download and export raw images. And as we were going through the documents, we also found that the TSA required that the devices include hard disk drives for storage, Ethernet connectivity, and USB compatibility. And we said, what's all that stuff for? Decoration? I mean, clearly we're talking about a device that has far more functionality than the public was being told. And once we learned these things, then we stepped up a campaign essentially pointing out that the TSA had misrepresented to the public what the devices could actually do. And then we did a series of special segments with CNN. Gene Mazur broke the story, and later Dan Rather's program, and Week in Review, and others. We had actually quite a lot of coverage in January of this year based entirely on the documents that we had obtained through the FOIA. But we found something else, and I think this is even the larger part of the story. It was something that we weren't looking for, and I think this is the experience of people sometimes who pursue FOIA requests. We were trying to assess the adequacy of the privacy safeguards, right? TSA had said certain things to the American public, and we basically figured out that what they had told the public was not true. But we found something else which may, in fact, have been more critical. In looking at the technical specifications of the body scanners, we learned that they were not designed, or at least we have good reason to believe that they were not designed to detect the type of powdered explosive, PETN, that was in fact involved in the December 25th incident and has largely been the argument in favor of the more rapid deployment of these devices in U.S. airports. Because if you look at the specifications document, you will see that the materials that they are designed to detect include weapons, explosives, and liquids, but not powders. And in fact, at the moment in time, which is the fall of 2006, when the TSA released the specifications documents to vendors, they had another device in place, which was the puffer device, to detect powdered explosives. That device, by the way, hasn't worked, and it's been pulled out of the airports, and they're reconsidering how to deal with that threat. But I'm trying to walk you through a critical but fantastically significant, insight we had about the body scanner program, which was, first of all, what the TSA had told the public about the effect, about the privacy safeguards was not correct. But secondly, they don't even prevent the type of threat that has largely become the justification for their deployment. And our reading of the documents was actually confirmed by a GAO report that came out in January that also suggested that these devices would not have detected the explosive used on December 25th, as well as a finding of independent experts in the UK. So the next step, and again, it's very political, you know? I mean, you really think, what is the purpose of open government in the use of the FOIA? The next step, in our opinion, is to shut down the program, or at least suspend it, until there's some further evaluation of whether these devices work as intended. There's a planned expenditure of almost $450 million in the current year to purchase about 500 devices and to hire the additional personnel to use the devices. And we did a letter actually last month with Ralph Nader to President Obama. We asked him to suspend the program pending a full review. We have another letter in the works that's been signed by about 30 organizations, and tomorrow we have a hearing before the House Committee on Homeland Security, where we will have the opportunity to talk about the significance of the documents we've obtained. This is the way I think FOIA should work. I mean, we may or may not win that political battle. Obviously, I hope we do. But you see, the opportunity to get access to documents, to challenge a government agency on something they propose to do, to find where they've made mistakes, and to be able to act on that information, is really what it's all about. So, there's obviously a lot more to be done. We just got another set of documents yesterday. This is also, I think, familiar to most people who do FOIA work. It's an interesting page, by the way, because this is an evaluation of the millimeter wave device as compared with a metal detector. So this is the millimeter wave device in the middle column. This is the metal detector in this column, and these are the various threats that were assessed. And I don't know if you can draw any inference from the length of the blacked out line in terms of what works and what doesn't. But at least someone is trying to answer the question of whether or not this new technology will do a better job promoting aviation security than the old technology. Now, I want to say a couple of words about another matter that we're pursuing. This is a little bit less satisfying in some respects. There's a lot of talk, as you know, about cybersecurity. It's become a critical issue in the internet community. There are many dimensions to cybersecurity. There are traditional threats, criminal hackers, industrial espionage. There are new emerging threats, including growing concerns about cyber warfare. The National Security Agency has been granted a very broad authority to conduct surveillance to promote and protect cybersecurity within the United States. And this broad authority translates into the ability to conduct surveillance on American persons inside this country, which obviously has significant implications in terms of online privacy and the debate we've had over the last several years about warrantless wiretapping. We have requested and now have a suit to obtain from the NSA NSPD 54, which was the presidential directive signed in January of 2008 by President Bush that granted the NSA and other agencies various authorities in the cybersecurity realm. We think it's absolutely vital that the legal authorities, we're not talking about the techniques or methods, but the legal authorities contained within this presidential directive be known because, of course, they have the force of law, and it's on this basis that federal agencies will be able to undertake surveillance against U.S. persons. And so we're proceeding with that suit against the NSA, and then this very odd thing happened a couple of weeks ago. The new cybersecurity czar, Howard Schmidt, got up at a very big conference on the West Coast, very big computer security conference, known as the RSA conference, to release the declassified version of the White House's cybersecurity policy. And, you know, we were looking forward to this. We thought that this was, you know, maybe going to be the first glimpse of the document that we had been trying to obtain through the FOIA. And if you read the news stories about Mr. Schmidt's speech, you'll see headline after headline, White House releases or White House security advisor releases declassified version of cybersecurity policy. So I was kind of excited about all this. And then I look at the document. The document was created for that West Coast conference. It was essentially 5 pages of talking points describing in the most general terms how the White House was planning to move forward on the cybersecurity. The information was known. Most of it was known, in fact. I don't think there were many surprises there. But what struck me about this was the use of the word declassified. Yes? I mean, when we talk about a declassification procedure, we have to believe that at some point in time, the document being referred to was, in fact, classified. And when you create a new document for public release, which is certainly what this document was, you've entered kind of a new realm of how we talk about open government and how we talk about secrecy. So in addition to our desire to ensure that the underlying cybersecurity authority, which is contained in NSPD 54, is revealed to the public, we have a great interest also in ensuring that these terms are properly used. I don't think you get to put the label declassified on top of a new document that's been created for public consumption. Finally, the last thing I just want to mention, EPIC, along with the National Security Archive and the ACLU, have been pursuing a very important case, which Tom may also say a few words about. This case actually goes back to 11 a.m. on December 16th, 2005, because that was roughly 4 hours after we had read the New York Times that morning, in which the story of the warrantless wiretapping program finally broke. After it was held up for almost a year, and it took us about 4 hours to craft the FOIA request that we wanted to submit to the Department of Justice to obtain the legal memos. We weren't interested in the techniques or methods. Again, we didn't want to jeopardize any investigations. We simply wanted access to the reasoning that supported the president's decision that he could engage in wiretapping without legal authority. Here we are, you know, 5 years.
Almost 5 years.
Thank you for that. Almost 5 years later, and we still haven't seen those memos. And that's actually a big disappointment. It's a big disappointment, not only to us, but I think to the American public, that we still don't know what the White House lawyers believed could be the basis for ignoring the acts of Congress and judicial authority. But I'll stop there.
Thanks, Mark. And Tom?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to speak about a pending FOIA lawsuit that we brought on behalf of Bloomberg News against the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. And again, because it's the litigation is still pending, it's currently on appeal. I need to be somewhat circumspect in my comments, but I'll try to lay out the issues, the arguments that have been made, and some of the larger implications that I see. This FOIA request was made back in, originally, the first FOIA request that's the subject of the lawsuit was made back in May of 2008, and it was supplemented thereafter. And it sought documents concerning the emergency lending facilities administered by the Federal Reserve System. The Fed's primary facility for injecting liquidity into the market and providing liquidity to banks is called the discount window or discount window lending. And during the recent financial crisis, that program was expanded to include related programs so that the Fed could inject liquidity into the financial system. And to give you a sense of the magnitude of the expansion, in August of 2007, the average outstanding discount window lending was $1 million. By October of 2008, that number had exploded from $1 million to $400 billion. So really, this sort of massive expansion of the use of public money to prop up private financial institutions. And Bloomberg News submitted a FOIA request to get the details of that lending. Who was borrowing, how much they were borrowing, what were the terms of the borrowing, and also what was the collateral that the government was taking in return for this borrowing to make sure that the public was being protected in terms of some reasonable expectation that it's going to get its money back. Bloomberg News and we had informal discussions with the Fed over the summer and early fall of 2008 in which they said, we're working on it, but don't expect to get any documents from us, and informally advised us that they were unlikely to respond favorably to the FOIA request. We sued on Bloomberg's behalf in November of 2008, actually prior to any formal response from the Fed, taking the position that it had been a constructive denial. And shortly thereafter, the Fed submitted a formal response objecting to the FOIA request. And they invoked two exemptions. Exemption 4, which I'll talk about in more detail in a little bit, but that protects confidential business information supplied by a private party to the government. They also invoked Exemption 5, which protects intra or interagency memoranda. They also argued that documents held by the Federal Reserve banks, as opposed to the Board of Governors, are outside the scope of FOIA, because unlike the Board of Governors, which is clearly an agency, they argued that the Reserve banks themselves are private entities, not government-controlled, and therefore outside the scope of FOIA. The parties agreed that we would proceed directly to summary judgment briefing. The board made their motion for summary judgment. We cross-moved for summary judgment. The board's primary argument was and continues to be that the disclosure of this information would cause competitive harm to the banks because it would stigmatize them. And the argument was some, but not all of these borrowers are on the precipice, on the brink of failure. And these Fed lending facilities are loan programs of last resort. And if the public, meaning if shareholders, if depositors, if other members of the public learned of the dire financial straits in which these banks found themselves, they would sell their shares, pull their deposits, go to another bank, and push the bank over the edge into ruin. And they argued that that constituted competitive harm. Our argument was that the showing of competitive harm was, at best, speculative. That while they produced affidavits from various Fed officials who I think clearly believe that this sort of doomsday scenario would result from disclosure, they produced or pointed to no objective evidence suggesting that that in fact would happen. And we introduced expert testimony from a former chairperson of the CFTC who argued from sort of an economic perspective, which I think dovetailed nicely with the underlying purpose of FOIA, from an economic perspective, more disclosure, more transparency leads to greater confidence in the market, and that the market tends to make bad decisions when there is an absence of reliable information. The more information available to the market, the more likely the market will make rational decisions. And of course, that sort of dovetails with the purpose of FOIA in terms of the public's confidence in governmental decisions and the public's ability to understand and assess and make rational decisions based on and in response to government decisions by having sufficient, reliable, real-time information on which they can assess those decisions. Well, come the summer of 2009, we get a decision from the district court. The district court with respect to documents held by the reserve banks themselves, said certain categories of documents held by the reserve banks are considered board documents, that is, documents in the custody of the Board of Governors. And those documents are picked up by the FOIA request. But other documents held by the Federal Reserve banks are not picked up by Bloomberg's FOIA request because Bloomberg, said the court correctly, did not make a FOIA request directly to the reserve banks. And so the district court, I think, reserved for another day, perhaps, decision on whether the reserve banks themselves are agencies. But the district court held that the government's, the board's, arguments regarding the competitive harm that would flow from disclosure were inadequate because they were speculative. The government failed to point to specific evidence to support its assertion that there would be this financial ruin were the public to be enlightened regarding the use of its money to prop up these banks. Shortly after the district court decision, an organization called the Clearinghouse Association moved to intervene so that it could participate in the appeal. The Clearinghouse Association is an organization representing the interests of the major banks. It was, the information in question is information reflecting the borrowing activities of some of the Clearinghouse members. And the Clearinghouse argued that it should be permitted to appeal so that it could ensure that its members' interests were protected. At that point, it wasn't clear whether the board was going to appeal or not, and that was one of the arguments why the Clearinghouse asserted it should be able to intervene to make sure that the appeal goes forward. The court granted the motion to intervene, and the district court also stayed its decision compelling disclosure pending appeal. And the rationale, and I think it makes sense, is that if the court were to order the immediate production of the materials, it would in effect obviate their appellate rights. And so the decision was stayed. The price for that stay, in effect, was that the board and the clearinghouse had to agree to an expedited appeal, which they agreed to, and which I think in the scheme of things we got, meaning the court's decision was in late August. Briefing on the appeal was completed in middle of December. We had a hearing with the Second Circuit in the middle of January, and we're now waiting for a decision. And in the scheme of things, in kind of litigation I practice, civil litigation, that's pretty quick. That's quick in terms of the district court issuing a 47-page decision on our summary judgment motion within 3 months of the motion having been fully briefed, and getting in front of the panel within, I guess, 4 months of the notice of appeal having been filed. So in many respects, that is expedited treatment. And I think the district court did its job in terms of considering the issues efficiently, but also on an expedited basis. I think the Second Circuit did its job in terms of granting an expedited appeal. But from the public's perspective, that's an awfully long time, obviously. And we're talking about documents that were generated in 2007 and 2008. Here we are, almost 2 years to the day after the FOIA request, and we still don't have any documents, even though we have a district court decision that says these documents should be disclosed pursuant to the FOIA. The key issues on appeal are, as I said, the issue of competitive harm and whether the government's showing of what we characterize as speculation regarding financial ruin that would be occasioned by disclosure of these lending details was sufficient under FOIA. In that regard, the government pointed to certain examples of what they said were instances in recent history in which the disclosure of this sort of emergency governmental lending led to runs on the bank. And the most recent example involved a UK bank called Northern Rock Trust. And in August of, I think, 2009, the BBC got news and published the report that the UK government was about to bail out Northern Rock. And that led to a run on Northern Rock's deposits. The House of Lords conducted an investigation, concluded there were lots of reasons for that. There's no meaningful deposit insurance in the UK, and so that got depositors spooked in a way that I would say would not happen in the US. The House of Lords also concluded that part of the problem here was that the information was leaked in advance of the bailout, and the government didn't really have an opportunity or an ability to proactively disclose and explain to the public what it was doing, why it was doing it, and what the ramifications would be. And we tried to use the Northern Rock example in our favor by saying, look, what this is showing is when there is uncertainty in the market, when there is uncertainty among members of the public, when there is a lack of clarity coming from the government, it leads to ill-informed decisions, rash decisions, and panic. It's interesting that the House of Lords also noted that what they called stealth lending, you know, this notion of, well, gee, maybe the UK government could have engaged in stealth lending to Northern Rock and sort of obviated any public misperceptions. The UK government, the House of Lords report said, but that would not have been possible, this notion of stealth lending, because under both UK and EU law, shareholders have a right to know this information. Shareholders of Northern Rock have a right to know that Northern Rock is facing these liquidity problems, that Northern Rock is taking government money. Again, going back to one of the arguments we made, which is shareholders of these banks have a right to know that the banks have these severe liquidity problems. And indeed, some of the banks did disclose their emergency borrowing. And from that, we argue that this information can't really have been confidential if at least some banks disclosed to shareholders, as we argued all the banks should have under the securities laws, that they had engaged in these lending activities. The other interesting issue is that might come out of this case is, what is an agency for FOIA purposes? We argued that information held by the reserve banks is subject to FOIA, and that the reserve banks themselves are agencies. Fed is taking the contrary position and saying, because these reserve banks are private entities, and because they don't engage in rulemaking, and because they don't have any adjudicatory authority, they're not agencies and they're not subject to FOIA. Our argument is that the cases make clear that the issue of agency status depends on whether the entity performs governmental functions and is subject to governmental control. And here, the board submitted several affidavits and made various arguments to the effect that the way we are able to affect monetary policy and the way that we're able to discharge our statutory obligation to affect monetary policy is through reserve bank lending. And so these reserve banks really are acting as our agents, for lack of a better word, or instrumentalities. From that, we argue that clearly they're engaged in governmental functions, and therefore they should be subject to FOIA. The other issue that sort of might come out of this is what constitutes information obtained from a third party versus information reflecting governmental action. And the reason that that issue has arisen is the following. As I said, Exemption 4 is the relevant exemption here. It protects or shields from disclosure commercial or confidential information obtained from a person that's privileged or confidential. And the key here is obtained from a person. A person is defined to mean not an agency. And so the board has said the way this lending works is borrowers show up at the window and they say, this is how much I want to borrow. And based on the Reserve Bank's rules, there will be certain payment terms in terms of how much they have to repay, when they have to repay, and the schedule for repayment and the interest rate. And so the reports in question, that Bloomberg is seeking and that the district court ordered the Fed to produce are records of those borrowing activities. And what the board has said is this information in these reports came from the banks, because the banks show up and say, hypothetically, Citibank shows up and says, I want to borrow $100 million. And so the Reserve Bank makes a notation. Citibank borrows $100 million. The banks are saying that is information that comes from Citibank, because Citibank is saying, I'm Citibank and I need $100 million. And therefore, it's obtained from a person, and that aspect of Exemption 4 is satisfied. Our argument is this is just a record of governmental activity. This is a record of governmental lending. This is a record of the government spending public money to prop up a private financial institution. Because it's not information obtained from a person, it doesn't come within Exemption 4. During the oral argument before the Second Circuit, a member of the panel was struggling with this and I think was skeptical of the board's argument. And I'll sort of take the court's question at oral argument and make it even more extreme to illustrate the point. You know, if ExxonMobil shows up at the White House and cuts a deal where they're able to drill in Yellowstone National Park for oil, you could say that the record of that deal reflects information obtained from ExxonMobil. Their name is ExxonMobil. This is the rights that they are seeking. This is what they're willing to pay for it. And I think clearly we would all recognize that that's a document, that hypothetical document is one that reflects governmental activity, doesn't reflect information obtained from a borrower. But we may get further clarification on that point, hopefully in the next couple months.
Let me just follow up with a couple of quick questions and then open it up to questions from the floor. One of them, just Tom, following there, would you agree with the part of the Fed's argument that essentially calls for, not to put a decent interval, shall we say, between the release of information about that potentially could cause panic or a run on the bank, that there is some period of time, but the sensitivity erodes over time?
Yeah, I think that you know, may be a fair position for the Fed to take, for the government to take, and the courts have recognized it, that you know, there may be instances in which, given the nature of the information, the disclosure of it in real time, or the disclosure of it within 20 days of its coming into existence, might be such that it would cause competitive harm, that it might disrupt law enforcement, give rise to national security implications. And so I accept that as a general matter, if certain kinds of information is sufficiently fresh, that there should be this cooling off period. I'm not sure what that cooling off period would be, and obviously it would depend on the nature of the information. Here our argument was, and the Second Circuit sort of pressed us on that, which is, well, what's a sufficient period of time? And our response was, it depends, and all we know is that in this case we're talking about 2 years, because in the case that's before the Second Circuit, we're talking about information that is no more recent than March of 2008. And so we're talking about information that's at least 2 years old. Clearly, with the passage of 2 years, any commercial injury would have dissipated, we argue. But, you know, I think that in the proper case, that might be a fair argument. I don't think it's applicable here.
Not here, yeah. And let me just ask Henry, and this is more an atmospherics question, because in a strange way, reading the way the Third Circuit is looking at corporations as having personal privacy, it sort of seems at least a kissing cousin to Citizens United and this interesting expansion of what corporations can and can't do. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that as an atmospherics going forward in this case.
Well, Tom, I mean, boy, I really can't say anything about Citizens United. That will really get me into trouble. But you're certainly right that there is a kinship there. I mean, you know, there have been various areas of law where the Supreme Court has recognized that corporations have certain constitutional rights. And one of these areas is, famously in the Bilotti case, is the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court certainly reminded us of that in the Citizens United case in a big way. What we've said about that, and this is something that, by the way, AT&T has relied on with great enthusiasm in the litigation, sort of making the type of argument that was accepted in Citizens United. One interesting thing about that line of cases, and what we pointed out is that the Supreme Court itself, and this is in footnote 14 of the Bilotti case, actually, has said that corporations do not have those rights that are, quote, purely personal. Well, gee, that language itself looks a lot like the precise language that Congress used in Exemption 7C, which protects, personal privacy. So we certainly are of the view that that line of cases does not support the result the panel reached here.
Interesting. I will ask Mark a question, but if anyone would like to pitch in, please come to, there's two mics right here. Would love to bring some questions from the audience. Let me just ask Mark, we know so much now about the wiretapping program, for example, since the revelations in the New York Times in 2005. There's even been an Inspector General's report from the IGs of the intelligence community. And we have extensive legal record of the development of unitary executive theories of the commander-in-chief powers from the release of the torture memos, for example, written by John Yoo and Jay Bybee and Patrick Philbin and others. So what's the holdup on the warrantless wiretapping memos? What do you think the...
You're asking me that?
Yeah, I'm asking you that. But what's your theory? I mean...
I don't know. I mean, look, the case is before Judge Kennedy. We've, I think made excellent arguments. And Tom's point actually goes to the fact that so much related to these documents has now been discussed in public, discussed by the administration. What we still need to see, of course, is the actual theories on which the White House relied. It may be the case that the judge was hoping that the Department of Justice on its own would, I'm still hoping. I mean, how many days are left in James Madison's birthday? It could be before the end of
Sunshine
the day.
Sunshine Week or Sunshine Week.
Then we can look forward to the end of the week. I mean, maybe the Department of Justice says, okay, it's about time to make these memos available. They've certainly made other memos available from the administration on their website, so it could happen this week, and maybe that's what the judge was thinking, the Department of Justice would do it on its own. And that's my best theory, actually.
Yeah. Rick Bloom, you want to weigh in with a question?
Yeah, I'm Rick Bloom with the Sunshine and Government Initiative. I'm not going to ask you whether non-binding mediation would have helped, but I wonder at what point would have non-binding mediation had the best chance of success in coming to an outcome that might have been acceptable in each of your cases?
I'll start. I don't think non-binding mediation would have gotten us anywhere, in part because we got to a point where we were talking about a fairly narrowly defined set of documents, and the board has said, no how, no way. I think in some ways, if there were greater communication between the requesting party and the agency in connection with formulating the request, that might sometimes help. So that if the agency were to say, look, you're asking for this, I think really what you want is this. And if that's what you're looking for, we can get that to you pretty quickly. But, I think, and lawyers are probably bear much of the blame here, where if we want a specific memo about a specific meeting, we say all documents concerning all meetings, including without limitation, this meeting. And if we just said, I want the memo concerning the March 14th meeting.
We do that in FOIA requests, too, a lot.
So maybe if there is some process by which someone at the agency picks up the phone and says, hey, I'm looking at your FOIA request. I see this is what you're looking for. This is what you're asking for. Can we have a conversation about what you really want, and maybe we can expedite this? Now, maybe that happens. It has not been my experience.
I just want to say, I mean, we've been doing this routinely for about 20 years. And, you know, we've trained a lot of law school students how to make FOIA requests. We ask them always to write a brief memo describing what they're looking for and why they're looking for it. And the two things that we look at when we review those memos, you know, have they actually defined the scope of the request in a way that the agency can be responsive? And have they established some reasonable basis to believe that the records exist, right? Now, when you go to an agency and you say, you know, we'd want documents including the March 14th meeting, and you cite a Washington Post story in which an administrative official has described the March 14th meeting, you have a very good reason to believe that that agency has the record, assuming you've sent it to the right agency, and they should respond to your request. You know, if you send them a request that says, you know, please send us all memos of any meetings that might have been held in March or any other months, I mean, you know, you may eventually find what you're looking for, but I actually think this is the right approach. Whenever you have a request to an agency, there's usually a telephone call that follows if the scope of the request is not appropriately narrow.
But you got the underlying data about the TSA system. Do you think it would have happened faster, or you would have gotten a better response? I mean, you did your expedited review. You found all this stuff about this.
Well, even the request was pretty narrow. I mean, you have to understand our organization is looking at dozens of systems of surveillance across Homeland Security. I mean, we're looking at the entry system, U.S. Visit. We're looking at CCTV. There are lots and lots of vendors. But with each request, we're going to try to be as narrow as we can because our theory has always been the more precise you can be in your request, the easier it is for the agency to respond, and the better record you're creating, you know, on appeal or you have to litigate, because there's this air of reasonableness about it, right? I mean, if you know the record exists, the agency's really not in a good position. You can argue over exemptions, that may happen, but they're not really in a good position to argue over whether they need to disclose.
Yeah. Henry, do you want to?
Sure, just briefly. Short answer, not much, probably. I mean, the background here, I mean, the FCC did withhold a lot of the documents on privacy grounds, but where those documents infringe on the privacy of individuals. And AT&T has taken this sort of categorical position that, no, none of these documents may be released. And really, we have a legal principle at stake there, and it's not going to be resolved through mediation.
Yes, sir.
I'm Whitfield Ippy. I'm on the Epic Board of Directors. I just sort of want to ask a strategy question that relates to some things that have been said. Mark and others referred to documents that had been released and put up on the websites by agencies. I implicitly sounded as though they had not explicitly responded to FOIA requests, but were in the areas of interest of the FOIA plaintiffs and were, so to speak, put up voluntarily. It's my observation looking at comparable documents from the NSA website, because they have commendably been going through old reports and things and putting up items of historical interest, that I believe the omissions might not be justifiable under FOIA rules. And so I'm going to ask if anybody has done or suggests somebody might have a policy of automatically watching what is, quote, declassified, and then making a FOIA appeal for the rest of it so that they know they're always going to have to justify their omissions against the FOIA.
It's a great, we have a project right now, in fact, right on your point, which is to go back and look at the torture documents that were released at the early stages of the ACLU litigation in New York, and we did amicus briefs and the like in that case. And those documents in 2005, 2006, 2007 were released under a certain standard, which the Obama administration has dramatically changed, both in its own executive order on declassification, but also, maybe more importantly, by its declassification of documents like the Inspector General's report on torture. And that sets a different standard of review. But then getting back into the process, you have a little bit of the zero-sum game, which is what Mark and I think Tom is talking about, where each new request, in a sense, slows down your previous request and processing. The system itself is not elastic enough. So we've had to go through a prioritization. There are literally 6,000-7,000 documents that we've been looking at. I think we've narrowed it down to a few hundred where we will try to compel that re-review that you're recommending.
I think a slight difference. Re-FOIA is something that you've gotten some of in the past and it's analogous to an appeal.
Right.
I don't know the rules about that. I'm just pointing out, I think it's actually different when an agency has released something under whatever its own internal standards is, and
right.
proposing a strategy that will eventually save everybody time, I think, because they will not try to get away with releasing something that doesn't come up to FOIA standards of giving out everything back on the requires.
Absolutely, but I also just think that those FOIA standards are in motion, which is to say they depend upon the signals from above, from leadership. They depend upon people like Senator Leahy saying to agencies, get on the case here. They depend upon White House signals and agency leadership and interagency processes like the ones producing these new executive orders, and the rubber hasn't yet met the road, I would say. But it's moving. Good point. Yes, please.
Good morning. Andrea Stevenson with CGS. I have two questions for Mr. Rotenberg regarding the scanners case. The first question is, what has been the response from TSA for the need for these body scanners if they don't detect the powder substances above what they use conventionally now? And the other question is, what has been the response from Department of Homeland Security? I know you said you have the hearing as regards to these scanners.
All right. Well, it's an excellent question, and I just want to mention, for people who are interested, we have both laptop stickers, if you'd like to put those on your laptops, and I also have a few sets of documents and related articles. Everything we obtained, we downloaded and burned onto CDs, so if you're interested in pursuing this, I'm happy to give you a CD. So you asked about the response from the TSA and the DHS, and they're, you know, it's a remarkable thing. I mean, you read the TSA webpage on this topic, and it's like this weird episode of Twilight Zone, because you see words and sentences that begin with capital letters and end with periods and so forth, and they still don't seem to convey meaning, and you're not quite sure what to make of it. And I say this because if you actually read the statements, they're contradictory. They say, for example, you know, TSA does not store and record images. Images are promptly deleted after they're stored. You understand what I just said, right? I mean, that's almost exactly what it says on the TSA site. They've been very reluctant to engage us on this particular issue. The only person who's actually been an outspoken advocate for the body scanners, and I would say on behalf of the agency, is the former secretary, Mr. Chertoff, who now represents one of the vendors, Rapiscan. And so he's disputed us on the point that the devices would not have detected the explosive powder used on December 25th. The Secretary Napolitano, oh, and here's actually an even better answer to your question. So on January 6th, now this was following that long period where the press was asking the White House to take a stronger stand on the December 25th incident, and finally President Obama and Secretary Napolitano spoke at a press conference January 6th, and they were asked several times about the body scanners. And I could tell, this is my view, others may disagree, go back, watch the video, read the transcript, I could tell from watching that press conference that both of them had been briefed and were told that the devices wouldn't work. And the reason I could tell would not work. They didn't say this, but let me just quickly, it's fascinating when you really dig into an issue. President Obama, when he was asked about, and there's a new term now, automated imaging devices, I think, said, well, we need to do more research. We need to get the Department of Energy involved. We need to develop new technologies. Well, why do you say that when there's a current technology that's being deployed? Secretary Napolitano was asked three times about body scanners. One answer was, you should anticipate more pat-downs. Another answer was, this is part of a multi-layer system of security. And a third answer was, we're continuing to test new technologies. All of these answers suggest that there wasn't a lot of confidence. So you see, it's subtle, of course, this debate. But I think the best answer to your question is that they, apart from former Secretary Chertoff, have been actually reluctant to counter our claims.
John.
Outside my area of expertise a little bit, but I'm kind of curious, if the Exemption 7 stuff, when would it expire? I mean, the idea of privacy is that it does expire, usually upon the death of a person. So I'm curious about the compliance to a corporation.
I don't know. It's a good question.
immortality of privacy. This is pretty extraordinary. Gary?
Sure. Well, as to the first question, where it originates, Third Circuit's decision is unprecedented. No other court has ever held this. Now, as I said before, there are various cases that have recognized that corporations have constitutional rights, and that's AT&T has made the argument that a right to corporate privacy, has tried to use those cases as support for their argument. There's a right to corporate privacy, because one of those lines of cases says that corporations do have some Fourth Amendment rights. So that's their argument. And again, for reasons I've indicated, we strongly disagree with that. As far as the status of the case, we had an adverse decision. The Third Circuit ruled against the government. We filed for rehearing en banc, which was denied. And we're currently considering whether to seek Supreme Court review by filing a cert petition.
Do you have a deadline for that decision?
April 22nd is the current deadline.
Other questions? Dan, do you want to? Can't hear you. You might need to turn it on.
Like that.
Oh,
yeah, that's with the second.
That's what does it.
Yeah.
Look at that. It's lit up green. That's a second extension of time that allows the Solicitor General until April 22nd in order to decide.
Right.
But I've got a question on behalf of one of my students. In my seminar here at the Washington College of Law, we've discussed Tom's case and the decision of the Chief Judge of the Southern District of New York last summer. And specifically, we've talked about the Exemption 4 argument that has been made, competitive harm and the run on the banks, so to speak. And one of my students said, listen, I just read all the exemptions. That's a very diligent student, of course. And I see this Exemption 8. And Exemption 8 of the Act is there to designed exactly for that purpose with respect to bank examination reports to prevent a disclosure of that sensitive information from leading to a run on banks. Well, if Congress went that far to guard against a run on banks, but no farther than the contour of Exemption 8, doesn't that provide a strong argument that Exemption 4 ought not to cover that, that Congress has already established the contour in addressing that run on bank concern? Has that come up in your case?
It has, and that's the argument we made, which is Congress recognized that there was a certain category of documents that might work a competitive harm concerning banks and their financial situation, and that information ought to be exempt from disclosure, in part because you want the banks to be forthcoming when the regulator comes in to look at its books. And our argument was Congress has spoken to this, and Congress has narrowly defined the category of documents that ought to be exempt. The banks tried to argue, I suppose, that there was a penumbra around Exemption 8. And they said, well, clearly Congress was concerned about not putting banks at a competitive disadvantage and about protecting sensitive information emanating from banks. And therefore, the court ought to sort of read this, add a judicial gloss onto Exemption 8. Obviously, the case law is uniform that FOIA exemptions have to be construed narrowly. And I don't think the court is inclined to sort of expand Exemption 8 beyond its literal terms. But so that issue has come up, and both sides found some support in Exemption 8.
Given also Gary's question about the unprecedented nature of an argument that there is such a thing as corporate privacy, at least privacy in this ordinary freedom of information sense, the argument that was made in your case of stigma, it comes pretty darn close to that.
It does.
I would imagine that had the briefing, the timing been different, the Third Circuit decision would have been cited by the banks in making that argument. Have they been able to identify anything else by way of precedent that would support this idea, this notion, I'll call it, that corporations are entitled to privacy?
Not in my case. In the Bloomberg case, the argument has been about the competitive impact and the injury to their competitive position. And one of the areas of legal dispute was whether or not reputational injury alone is sufficient. Judge Preska, in our case, relying on certain district court decisions from the District of Columbia, held that mere reputational injury does not constitute competitive injury for purposes of Exemption 4, and that what the banks would have to show is affirmative use of this information by a competitor in order to gain a competitive advantage. The banks say, you know, gee, just because a couple of district courts have said that in footnotes doesn't mean that that's the law and that the Second Circuit should reject that. But the issue sort of comes close, I think, to the privacy argument in that if Judge Preska is right, at least with respect to Exemption 4, that, you know, injury to someone's reputation or to a corporate entity's reputation is not sufficient to trigger Exemption 4. Maybe the same argument would apply to Exemption 3.
Tom, do you think it's too much of a jump to imagine that in the next such case like yours, now that the Third Circuit has ruled as it has, unless that ruling is overturned, that the bank may make an argument not just under Exemption 4, but under Exemption 6?
I think it sounds likely.
That seems to be the trend toward corporate privacy. That
yeah, way. And, you know, I would not, there have been rumblings that if, from the other side, that if the Second Circuit affirms in the Bloomberg case that they will seek cert. And so it may be that this all sort of gets up together.
Joy, so, Henry, you want to make a comment on
that? Well,
this?
I should just say that on the Exemption 6 question, which is an important one, the Third Circuit did try to cabin its holding and say that it did not necessarily apply to Exemption 6. In our en banc petition, we attempted to attack that distinction and say that the Third Circuit's distinction didn't really make too much sense. It's the same, it's the very same language that's used in both Exemption 6 and Exemption 7C. And as we pointed out, there is a fairly long and distinguished line of cases under Exemption 6 pretty clearly saying that it's limited to individual privacy, or the privacy of individuals, which we certainly believe is strongly supports our position. The only other thing I'd say is that this concept of stigma, you know, I think that when we talk about a corporation's reputation, we mean something different than we mean reputation of an individual. We mean things like stock price and things like that, you know, the effect on the bottom line, whereas in terms of individuals and talking about privacy, it's something more bound up in autonomy and dignity, something distinct from what a legal entity has, which is the point we've made in our petition.
Well, I'll be telling my students in my seminar, and I guess everyone else can imagine, that we should tune in this time next year, perhaps, to see whether, Tom, your case is heading to the Supreme Court, and whether your case, Henry, is heading to the Supreme Court as well.
And hopefully Mark will also have some nicely blacked out versions of the wiretapping memos to
right.
hold up as well.
And hopefully that wouldn't require Supreme Court intervention, perhaps. That's the theme. But it looks like that's certainly a trend where we have to be concerned about the possibility of corporate privacy sort of creeping forward in a counter way to sunshine and government. Sure.
Hear, hear. And on that note, if there aren't further questions, we'll draw our panel to an end. And join me in please thanking our panelists for an interesting review.